Okay, what should we talk about? last time I was up here talking, it was about 6 months ago. It was dealt with hominids. Remember that? Some of you were here. And it took two Sundays, so this one should only take one time, I hope. And recall what some of the big subjects were, the interesting subjects to skeptics that Reasons to Believe have figured out, the ID movement has figured out. There's at least seven or eight. Well, I guess there's a long, long list. But the top ones, the top four, of course, are origin of the universe, like when it happened and so on. Origin of life, that's what we're going to talk about today. And change in life, you know, down through the eons. Why has life changed? Why does it appear to have evolved? And then lastly was hominids. Actually, hominids is the most popular subject to talk to if you want to engage a skeptic or even another religious person. You know, that's the number one subject. This one's about number two, so how life originated. And so, you know, maybe over the next year or so, I'll be able to go through several of those if I get the chance. This one, starting with origin of life, and by the way, I have to thank Mark Perez, a member of our class who I don't see here today. He's the one that gave me this slideshow, although I've done a fair amount of modification to it. He used it at Lake Avenue, I think it was. You were there with him, right, Ross? Yeah. So I've added several slides and changed some. But he's got some great artistic stuff in here. Oh, Mark. Thank you, Mark. He's sitting in the back of the class there. And thank you for the slideshow. I have modified it. You said I could. Okay, why? Why do we care about this? We as Christians... And we pretty much are in agreement in this class on it. Maybe there's a few differences. Why care about it? Besides talking to skeptics, what does it do to our philosophy of life? I mean, if we believe life started accidentally, naturally, God said he made man. In other words, our special revelation, the Bible tells us that. And if you believe in the Bible says God made man and made other life, too. So there's a very good reason for us to know about this in a technical sense. And I'm going to get into a little chemistry at times. So, you know, just bear with me. It won't be too much. And I know most of you have sort of a technical background, or a lot of technical backgrounds. So I think you can withstand it. Okay. The argument against naturalistic origin of life is negative. In other words, we have a lot of negative information to show that it's just not accurate. But we as Christians still have to beware of falling into the God of the Gaps trap. And the God of the Gaps would be, anyone want to take a venture, a guess on what that is? Yes. Right. It's the sort of the Bible Belt answer. So we got to be careful doing that. That's not the way to come back to a skeptic. Instead, it's to use technical information and be more considerate and compassionate. The power of the origin of life problem is that it strips evolution of its status as a fact. Is it a fact? It's the first part of the evolutionary chain, the bottom of the tree. And we get into this, you'll see that scientists, evolutionists, throw their hands up on this issue. They can't come up with a good answer. It's extremely important to remember that evolution theorists, no matter how vacant the evidence, cannot concede a divine origin of life. If they do, they open the door to the God of the Gaps. It's scientifically unacceptable for them to do that. The basis of science is a search for physical cause or physical effects. Anything else discourages scientific research. That's the truth. So it's philosophical and religious. And let's see here. Okay. Talking about the earliest period for the Earth, the Earth was formed about 4.56 billion years ago. And about 50 million years later, or 4.51, yeah, we might need the lights down. Billion years ago, a Mars-sized object struck the Earth. Mars would be, what, about, oh, five or six times the size of the Moon. And it literally took a glancing blow off the Earth. And the collision caused a disk of ejecta, which formed the Moon, at that time about 50,000 miles away. The spinning material coalesced into the Moon. And our Moon is so large, I think you're all aware that it's kind of what you could call a secondary planet rather than a Moon. Extremely big for a planet the size of the Earth. And most of Earth's very heavy atmosphere was blasted away. So a lot of the compounds in the atmosphere then, which were poisonous, were just blasted right off the surface. And heavier elements of the collider, as we call this, this, don't have my pointer, but of the object that hit the Earth, actually included radioactive elements and iron and other materials that stayed on the Earth. The lighter material was ejected, and that's what became the Moon. The Earth was in a molten state then. And as time went by, the Earth continued to be bombarded with many meteorites and comets. The entire solar system was hammered with continuing flow of strikes. So, of course, that kept the Earth's surface molten. At 4.56 billion to 3.5 billion years ago, meteorites and comets impacts kept the surface molten. The surface temperature was about 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit and molten to a depth of 200 kilometers, or about 120 miles. Needless to say, no kind of life could exist then. And we call this period of time the Hadean era on the Earth. Genesis 1:1 is thought to cover this period. Take a look at Genesis 1:1. That would be the first sentence on this page. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Of course, the heavens, including all the galaxies and stars, were created about 13.7 billion years ago. And the earth, about 4.56, our solar system, about 4.56 billion years ago. And the surface was molten. Water was a vapor. The atmosphere was thick with carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane, water, cyanide, I should say. So there were, it was a pretty hostile condition there. Nothing could live on the earth. And Genesis 1:2, now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering or brooding over the waters. And formless and deep, the Hebrew words tohu and bohu, this would indicate that there was water on the surface. So this would have to be at the end of the Hadean period. You know, you can see right there, the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So apparently the surface had solidified, water had condensed from vapor and formed the ocean. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm speaking right after that. The 5,000 degree period would be during Genesis 1:1. I'm now in Genesis 1:2. So I'm finally dividing. Yeah, dividing it. The evidence would be the fact that there's water. So The surface of the earth could no longer be molten if there was liquid water on it. What other liquids would you be referring to then? But on the surface of the earth, what other liquids are there? Yeah. The fact that it says water means that there was liquid water, though. And it says it's over the water. Are you saying the spirit could be out and beyond the vaporous stage of water? Right. Certainly. Yes, and what I'm doing is just interpreting it my own, there's several ways you can interpret this. To me, I could apply this and understand it to mean that the earth had solidified and there's liquid water on it. Marley? Yeah? Surface would indicate. Well, you could have a molten surface still. Yes, Marley. Yeah. Right. Certainly at this point, if there is liquid water, there's certainly gaseous water, too. Solid water, it's hard to say, if there's ice and snow. Right. No. Whether it's molten or not, the spirit could hover wherever the spirit wanted to. Yes, John. Have you ever heard of cyanide? Usually cyanide is a compound, sodium cyanide or potassium cyanide. And cyanide is CN2H2. So it's a very small molecule. When it separates from its compound from the metal, that's when it's deadly too, because you're smelling the... the cyanamide. But when it's combined with potassium or sodium, it's called cyanide. So, yeah, that's right. No. Okay. So yes, I'm. There is some conjecture here. I'm just trying to relate some of this to what was going on during that Hadean period and right. Very shortly after that. Okay, now this is probably going to get more controversial at this point. let's see. Don, can you read that? Can you see it well there? Okay, still in Genesis 1, very, very beginning. And so light became visible. That's the way we're interpreting this, okay? It doesn't necessarily mean that you can see the orb, the sun up there, or the moon, or the stars. But there's light coming through. As today, you can't see the sun, but it's filtering through the clouds. It's translucent, we'd say. And... let's see. Sunlight was able to penetrate. Sun, moon, and stars were not visible. What could happen at this point on Earth if there's light? Photosynthesis. So, looking at these two these verses together, these five verses, some Bible commentators believe that life could have actually started. The Holy Spirit could have formed life back at day one. Not day one. Before day one was actually pronounced. But when the Holy Spirit was hovering. When the Holy Spirit was hovering in Genesis 1-2, the word hovering, rahap, I believe is what it's called in Hebrew. There's only one other place it's used in the Bible, and that's in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 32:9-12. And in that case, God is referring to himself brooding over Israel when it was first formed, when it became alive. So some Bible commentators would go back to Genesis 1-2 and say that the first life could have been formed then. Not necessarily when it's explicitly pronounced in Genesis, which is the next few verses. And so initially, if life were formed in that manner, it wouldn't have been photosynthetic. It would have been autotrophic, but more like a chemotroph, living off of chemicals in the water or near hydrothermal vents, wherever certain chemicals were concentrated. So it just, you know, again, I know that's it's getting a little controversial here, but it is a possibility that life could have been formed that early. And almost back to the very moment that the earth solidified and water became liquid. Yes. Right. God is, I've always said he's the master ecologist. And so he makes, you know, almost an infinite number of ecosystems on Earth. And he doesn't, it's just, you know, from his MO is to make ecosystems, to make things symbiotic, to make many forms of life interact. And so my guess is he started off making a lot of species of these autotrophs, thermophiles, extremophiles, as they're called, so they could interact together and set up an ecosystem. Those are one-cell bacteria and archaeans, as we call them. And so the whole Earth could have had such a type of ecosystem. But my guess is there would have been many species of single-celled prokaryotes or bacteria-like organisms. Okay, again, the atmosphere somehow became thinner and light was able to come through. We think that, well, that initially that collider helped. You know, it knocked out some of the gases, a lot of the gases that were around the Earth, but that was 0.8 billion years earlier than this. And so, but the Earth, a lot of the molecules that were on Earth that were shielding the light from reaching the surface, like methane and, a few others were light and weight enough that they escaped the Earth's atmosphere. Gravity could not hold them in. And so that and the dust settling from the bombardment, the late heavy bombardment, as we call it, of the meteorites, and when that stopped, you know, all this stuff settled out, the gases escaped, then light was able to penetrate the surface. Okay. Now here's a timeline, just to give you a rough idea when things happen. Almost as soon as the rock solidified, life appeared. This is a huge problem for the evolutionary model. The observation reports of the first chemical residues confirming light are not in dispute, though. 3.8 to 3.83 billion years ago, right when things solidified. First fossils that we find were about 3.5 billion years ago. So how do we know life was there 3.8 billion years ago? We'll get into that in a minute. This gives chemical evolution only 20 to 50 million years at the most to go from a completely sterile world to fully functional. Okay. Let's look at a simple form of life. And I like the way somebody put quotes around simple. Is a bacterium simple? We used to think so up to about 20 years ago. And then as we got better and better microscopes and saw what was going on inside of these things, they're anything but simple. Extremely complex. And this photo here is can only touch on how complex it is. First living things were bacteria, or archaeans, another group that looked just like bacteria. They may not have had flagella, but they had cell walls, membranes, cytoplasm, DNA, RNA. You can see the various components of the cell there. Now, are those just haphazardly thrown into a bag of life, where things just move around? No, all these materials are layered in there. Yes, they can move around. There's actually mechanisms. There's little machines that move the parts around in there, biological machines. But they're all layered, and the layers are moving around and intertwining and working together. Biochemical processes are going on. So it's a lot of interdependency. It's not just a bag of chemicals and little machines thrown in together. Yes, Valerie. Right. Yeah, Darwin, you know, I always give Darwin credit. He was he came up with a brilliant hypothesis. I wouldn't call it a theory. But, you know, it was just based on the information he had. It was detective work. He put it together. And then the conclusion he came to, though, was really taking, a real leap of faith. And then he called it a theory and published it as a fact. But, you know, that's where he went wrong. But at least he had the honesty to make a statement like this. And this was the sixth edition of Origin of Species. And he finally came out with that statement. So, you know, I think today we can readily confirm. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't show all the books that I'd use, but it's in here. Some of you have seen this book. Darwin's Black Box, and on page 39, you know, you can get that quote. I mean, unless you have the sixth edition of Origin of Species. He did say that, but he fully expected that it would go his way. Okay, sure. Better yet, Bertrand, the board man. Can you read it from there? You can see it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that word evolution is, if you use it in an innocent sense, I mean, life evolved on Earth. It changed over time. Did it undergo Darwinistic evolution? No. You know, we have a lot of evidence that it didn't. It was God replacing species after species. And, it's that form of evolution. So you got to be careful with that word. But of course, he was talking about his own cookbook type. Yes, Jocelyn. Good question. Right. Okay. And I will get to that later, but I'll just touch on it now. How many genes, in other words, does it take to make life? What does a cell like this need to be called life and be able to function? And is that what you were asking? Go ahead. That's exactly right. About around 1,500 genes, which could make around 1,500 proteins. And that would be a bacterium that's autonomous. That is, it can live on its own. Now, if you took a parasitic type, you know, something that had to live off of others, it could have a smaller genome, as we call it, and it could have 250 genes because it's living off the proteins that the host is making. It doesn't need to make them. And there are some like that, some parasites with a small one. But the autonomous, yes, sir, in the back. Mm-hmm. Well, they are. If this were a photosynthetic bacterium, and there are some like the blue-green algae, and they make those stromatolites, you know, they're... Stromatolites are either, they can be this big, it's a mass of calcium and organisms mostly, or they can be this big, huge thing, real tall. They don't exist much anymore on Earth, but there are a few examples, and we find fossils. But so if this were photosynthetic, there would also be some layering in there of chlorophyll. So it would be even more complicated. That's why I said the non-photosynthetic bacteria very likely came first, while the earth was still a little dark. And then immediately, God very likely produced photosynthetic bacteria once light penetrated. But you're right, it would just be more complex. Yeah, Ross. Yeah. That's another way to compare it. That's very good. In fact, I will get into more detail on that. How do we know there was a bacterium that long ago, though? I mean, we don't. I told you we only found fossils, these microfossils, to 3.5 billion. Yet, you know, I'm standing here saying we're pretty sure there was life to 3.85 billion. Well, what we find all the way back there are chemical signatures, fingerprints of God. We find kerogen, which is a tarry material, and it we find graphite and a few other things. But the reason we are pretty sure that those were formed by living organisms, it's kind of like kerogen is kind of like real thick petroleum, and I think Hugh compares it to that sticky, gooey stuff on your barbecue grill, you know, when you don't clean it, and so. I'll be with you in a second, Steve. Okay, and so the kerogen. So what? You find kerogen. How do you know it was something from a living organism? There's carbon all over the earth. You know that's not from a living organism. Well, we look at the isotopes in it, and if you compare the carbon 12 and 13, 13 being the isotope, the radioactive one, you find a disproportionate amount of carbon 12. There should have been a certain ratio of carbon 12, the carbon 13, and instead you find way more 12 than you expect, and that's exactly what plants do. They selectively choose carbon 12 over carbon 13, you know, disproportionate to what's in the atmosphere. So we find that in the kerogen. We also find it with nitrogen, 14 and 15. In that case, 15 is the isotope. And plants selectively choose the heavier one. In this case, they choose the isotope over the non-radioactive one, and so we find that disproportionate ratio also. So we have this evidence that the kerogen is from plants all the way back to 3.85 billion years ago. like eukaryotes, but the single-celled prokaryotes like blue-green algae. Yeah, they would use nitrogen also and concentrate it through photosynthesis, through the metabolism associated with it. The only way they can tell is from photosynthetic bacteria, because a non-photosynthetic bacteria, I haven't read anything about chemical signatures of those. If anybody knows, you know, we're welcome to talk about it. But it's the photosynthetic ones which were, of course, critically important in those early days for producing oxygen and changing the whole environment of the Earth. And so God really concentrated on photosynthetic bacteria. Those are what we're finding the chemical signature of. There probably are for non-photosynthetic ones. I'm not sure what they would be, though. Yes. Yeah. I'll get into more detail on that in a minute, too. Good point. Speaking of the RTB model, here's a few of the predictions. Life appeared as early as possible on Earth. I'm only giving you a few of them. First, life was complex and had design. By the word design, and the way I'm using it, means that there was supernatural design built into it. It came on the Earth so quickly, it didn't have time to evolve into existence, such as cell structure, biochemistry, and all the things we just spoke of. Third, first life was qualitatively different from life created on days 3, 5, and 6. For instance, we had these single-celled bacteria, or prokaryotes as they're called. They don't have a nucleus, so we call them prokaryote. And when we look at the fossil record, we had eukaryotes. Those are cells, single cells with a clearly defined nucleus, nuclear envelope, membrane. And finally, we had multicellular eukaryotes. So that's a third prediction. A fourth of the RTB model, life was created to prepare Earth for the advent of humanity. All this stuff going on, if you look at it, what happened over the eons, the Earth became better and better suited for humanity. That was God's purpose. The anthropomorphic hypothesis, I believe, is the name for that. Yeah, John? Yeah. Yeah, the young Earth theory is, that's another issue. Somebody ought to give a talk on that. I compare that to the flat Earth society, at this point in time. Yeah, let's get on here. get into a few facts here. Oops. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Okay, we spoke a little bit about some of this already. Evolution posits that the chemicals required for early life on Earth existed sometime just before life appeared. Evolution also posits that the conditions on Earth were such that the chemicals required to make the building blocks of life would actually cause those chemicals to assemble. And evolution requires that after the initial molecules formed, they joined into more complicated molecules, which, if properly assembled, would create life. So, finally, evolution states that these complex molecules not only existed and assembled, but they automatically became alive. In other words, they became self-replicating, organic. So, here's a good one Mark put in here. Seeds of life. Okay, the term seeds of life is often used, I'll try to scrunch down here a little so everyone can see, is often used by evolution theories to refer to the isolated chemicals that supposedly existed early on Earth. Those chemicals, if they existed, supposedly formed life from non-life. The purpose of origin of life research is to determine whether these chemicals really are seeds of life. When you hear that term referring to anything other than actual living seeds, challenge the presumption. Because, you know, to say that a chemical molecule is a seed is really taking liberty. A little bit of definition on prebiotic soup here. Prebiotic means those elements like nitrogen, phosphorus, carbon that make up more complicated molecules. And we already mentioned some of them. You have like ammonia with NH3, CO2, carbon dioxide, methane with CH4, and water, and then cyanamide. I mentioned that earlier. those are prebiotics. And they, of course, can be in solution in water. And biotic would mean those much more complicated molecules made up of the prebiotic chemicals. These can join together and form sugars, nucleic acid or nucleotides, proteins, lipids or fat. So those are biotic. Biotic chemicals, evolutionary theory holds that these molecules form from the prebiotics when conditions were right. The fully organized cell emerged from the prebiotic soup. So, prebiotic soup is a combination of simple compounds like carbon dioxide, water, you know, methane and so on. And those join together in the soup and form more complicated things like amino acids, nucleotides, and sugars. And all that together makes what we call a prebiotic soup. At least that's what the evolutionists call it. With time, life comes out of that because the molecules have a seed-like attribute. First molecules, origin of life researchers run into a big problem with prebiotics. First is that they are either too scarce to make the chemicals. Next is that even in the laboratory, under controlled conditions, researchers have found that some of the crucial biotic molecules can't form because of chemical conflicts. And a few other problems, such as the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. We'll get into that a little more in a second. Scarcity. Phosphorus, which is very, very critical element for many things, for nucleotides, nucleosides, for energy transporting molecules, many, many things in your body. Many molecules require phosphorus. These things for us, for our technology, we can get to phosphorus and things like that easily now, but very rare. Chemical conflicts, adenine, guanine, cytosine, uracil, and thymine are nucleosides. They're the things that make up the DNA. They're big molecules. And you've all seen that double helix. Each of the little units in there are one of these, adenine or guanine. They make up DNA and RNA. And the trouble is, to create
adenine and guanine require freezing temperatures. At the same time, cytosine and uracil require boiling temperatures. So, you know, you got to have these things produced at the same time so they can go into making nucleic acid, DNA or RNA. And so that's a kind of unlikely thing to happen. That's just one difficulty. Yes, Marlene. Yes, I'm talking outside of the cell now. You know, I'm going back to what the evolutionists would posit. Okay. And the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. This is kind of a killer for getting these prebiotic and biotic chemicals. Oxygen destroys chemical pathways to prebiotic molecules. Oxygen, what does it do to iron? Yeah, rust it, right? What does it do? If you have aluminum, excuse me, anything made out of aluminum, you've seen aluminum rust too. It gets kind of a white powder on it, and so on. You know, everything oxidizes. We do. You know, that's what, yeah, we're always oxidizing. And, well, our metabolism, you know, we'd be, it's good and bad. You know, we couldn't get energy out of food if we didn't oxidize it. So, on the other hand, too much oxidation, and it kind of does damage to your body. Yes, Steve? How did oxygen first form? Radioactive decay initially from a lot of them. The radioactive materials came from that collider event. And the Earth had some of its own radioactive material too, but water molecules, H2O, can be broken down by radioactive energy. And so that, and then, of course, followed by photosynthetic actions of those first bacteria. They would make oxygen also. That's a byproduct of photosynthesis. Yeah. Oh, okay. anyway, where was I? Let's see. Yeah. So if oxygen is present, chemical pathways that lead to life outside of the cell would be oxidized. They can't occur. If oxygen is not present, you don't get the ozone layer forming. What happens then? You get ultraviolet light coming in from the sun and other sources, and those destroy chemicals. So either way, it's a lose-lose situation. And how could the first life start if the chemicals couldn't even be synthesized naturally? Yes, sir. There is. I think bromine, if I remember right, stops it. The only thing is, bromine's kind of heavy, the bromine gas, and it won't stay up in the atmosphere. It'll go down to real low spots, you know, like the Death Valley and places like that. But I don't know of anything else. There might be possible. And as we look at over history of the Earth, we see there were periods of oxygenation and then anoxic or lack of oxygen period. We can tell because there's these iron layers laid down in the around the Earth, when there was the oxygen would, I don't know what you know what the chemical reaction is. The layers of iron are directly related to whether you had oxidative processes going on or reductive processes. So you get different layering, and you find that
the Earth had a history of going through, you know, this cycle. And okay.
Other sources of chemicals. Is there anything else that could have given us some of these? Volcanoes certainly give some, but very little. Deep sea vents. If you had, one of the theories is this is the most likely place that a biological soup could have occurred, a prebiotic soup, because of the heat and the chemicals coming out of the vents, which are mostly volcanic related. And you could have had these chemical reactions there, leading to more complex compounds, which eventually could have gotten together, because remember, they're seeds of life, and formed protocells and then life. And so the problem is, it's so hot around these things that the heat from the vents destroys the chemicals. So it's just, again, it doesn't work out, and they've kind of given up. The experts have given up on the volcanic vents now as the origin place. Jocelyn here. Yeah, extremophiles. They're there. Yes. Right. I was referring earlier, though, that might be the type of thing that the first cells that God made did exist around those kind of vents. And by the way, there are a lot of those. They're really discovering a lot of those. I think Mark had a quote here. The entire water of the oceans passed through them every 10 million years. That's a short time geologically. And so, yes, there are organisms that can take that extreme heat and survive. But life can't start there. Panspermia. Let's see here. Yeah, one of my... something got dropped off here. But another source of chemicals is what we... from meteorites and comets. And not sure what happened to the slide there, but another word for that is panspermia. That is, chemicals are brought in by meteorites or comets or dust from outer space. You know, they hit the Earth's atmosphere. Some of them can reach the surface without being totally denatured or destroyed by the heat. And it's far too low. The absolute best scenario, there would be about 0.02 ounces of biological significant amino acids that could be delivered per year to the Earth. 0.02 ounces? You know how little that is? You spread it out over the whole surface of the Earth. The concentration of meteorite-delivered amino acids would be a million times lower than the purest water on Earth. So that's not enough to make soup. So the panspermia idea is not too good. Oh, there it is. It got stuck. Okay. Laboratory experiments. Yes, there are highly controlled experiments. That you've all heard of the Stanley Miller, or Miller-Urey, it's called, experiment back in the 50s. You know, he was the first one, even though the idea had come out in the 20s. He set up an experiment where he put all the basic compounds like ammonia, methane, CO2, water, and so on, and in a sterile flask with a spark of energy running through it. And after a few weeks, he did, and very careful control, he did get a few amino acids like glycine, very simple amino acids that don't turn, they're very difficult to change those into other amino acids. And of course, you know, the evolutionists jumped on that and thought that was it. You know, we're going to prove within a decade or two that life can occur spontaneously. It never happened. After thousands of people started into that research, they just never got it much more than he got. So that kind of died out. Uh, Another chemical problem is what we call the beautiful art there, Mark. Chirality. Okay? Like chiropractor. It means hand in Greek. So looking at your two hands, my left hand's a mirror image of my right hand, right? Or vice versa. And so when chemicals are made, these organic chemicals, they naturally form either left or right hand, or both. Both are formed, left-handed and right-handed chemicals. When you form a glycine amino acid, it comes out left and right. When you form a sugar, like ribose, it comes out left and right. And so is that a problem? Yes, it's a very big problem in terms of life. Some examples that you're more familiar with are like vitamin E and let's see, we mentioned the amino acid. So handedness is very important. Wrong-handed problems, one right-handed amino acid disrupts a protein fold. So you got to have pure left-handed amino acids to get life. And when they're produced, if you always get 50-50, you know, you're going to have the wrong ones connecting up in the protein. It's going to destroy things. A DNA strand can't bind. If there's DNA has it's closely associated with protein. So if any one of those amino acids are on there, it won't work. And so that's just a very big problem for the naturalist. So where do they come from? These homochiral molecules. Homo means same, chiro means handed. We said that you have to use left-handed amino acids. Where do they come from? The only place that they're produced is in living cells. It doesn't happen naturally. There are little evidence that in outer space that neutron star radiation can change the ratio from 50-50 a little bit, but not enough to make much difference. I'm trying to make the time here. So. I didn't go by that. Another one I added. Irreducible complexity. We talked about it earlier. A system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function. Removal of any one part causes the system to effectively cease functioning. Remember back at the cell? Every little part on that simple cell, like the cell membrane, if you didn't have that, you know, the lipids that had to go into that, you couldn't have life. If you didn't have the cell wall, you couldn't have that life. If you didn't have the ribosomes, you couldn't have life. This is a very big problem for the naturalist, irreducible complexity. Way to think of it is like a mousetrap. It's composed of six parts, platform, spring, hammer, catch, and the holder bar. If you're missing any one of those, its system won't work. So that they're all irreducibly complex. Well, the cell is a lot more so than that. For instance, somebody brought up earlier, I think Jocelyn, that it takes 1,500 genes for life to be life. And that would mean 1,500 proteins would come from those 1,500 genes. Now, some of those combine together to make one long protein. But, all the proteins in the living cell are interdependent in some degree. They're interdependent. They need each other for the cell to function. And just to get one protein, a guy named Hubert Yockey, the biophysicist, calculated the chance by accident is 10 to the 75th. One chance in 10 to the 75th to get an accidental functional protein. And so, you know, that's a 10 with 75 zeros behind it, and a 1. And so anything, greater than 10 to the 50th is considered statistically absolute. But if you look at the bacterium with 1,500 proteins, the odds of all that happening by accident are 1 chance in 10 to the 112,500 power. So you can imagine that many zeros after 10. And for 1,500 genes to accidentally be formed and come together and make the system work,
it's so absurdly remote, it just isn't going to happen. Yes, Steve.
Are now looking at some really exotic ideas like directed panspermia. That would be the, you know, the little green men bringing the life here on Earth. It would evolve. They'd come back and reseed occasionally. And hidden forces of physics, another law of physics that outweighs the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, it would be a law that would force, it would be anti-chaos. It would force things, chemicals, to come together. Sort of like the seeds of life for the little chemicals, too. It would be something we just haven't discovered yet. In other words, they're appealing to the unknown. And that's what we call the gambler's fallacy. Their arguments are non-scientific. That's what they're being. It's becoming now. They're philosophical. Points to remember. We'll be done here in a couple minutes. There's no primordial soup. None has ever been found. Can't make it in a lab either. Prebiotics were scarce or non-existent. Chemical conflicts such as chirality. We mentioned the left and right-handedness. How do you get around that? Very difficult. Lab experiments proving chemical pathways require intelligent controls. Like that Stanley Miller thing. They had to, every day, every hour, check the temperature, make sure that it wasn't getting polluted or infected with bacteria. And so, you know, even in the lab, though, we're not doing very good. We got the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. Amino acids and crucial sugars require 100% right or left-handedness. And the only time we find that is in living systems, already living. Challenge the seeds of life presumption that chemicals have some force or they're associated with some unknown force that allows them to spontaneously create life. Life is irreducibly complex. The last one. Any questions? Final comments. Yeah, Jocelyn. Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Is that the one you're going to give me? I do covet that. Okay, well, if that's it, then thank you, and I'm sorry for having to rush it. Thanks.